Okay, so before we get to our shaming of Cisco that we want to start with this afternoon, I want to talk about something that's a little funny. Has nothing to do with technology, but I think it's hilarious. There is apparently a guy. His name is Samir, and he's got like one of those last names. I don't even want to say it because I'll probably butcher it. Rezami, I think is what it is.
Sure, rhymes with salami.
Yeah. He created a song for, like, if you plug your phone into a car or connect it with, well, usually it's like when you plug it in to, like, the USB adapter or whatever with a lightning cable or whatever. I think it's mainly for iPhones. The car will start playing the first song in your music library alphabetically. And so you plug your car in, you plug your phone into your car, and you hear, like, this first song, like, all the time. So he came up with this great idea that he created a 10-minute silent song. And called it A space, A space, A space, A space, A space, very good song. And apparently it is like climbing the iTunes chart.
Did he charge for this song?
Yes, he has charged 99 cents for this song. And right now, well, according to the screenshot on Engadget, it is above like a Kendrick Lamar song, a Fifth Harmony song, and it's climbing up there with a new Kesha song and Bruno Mars. I mean, it would be so funny if this guy's song of 10 minutes of silence makes it to the top of the iTunes chart.
Well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and say that that song is probably better than any of Selena Gomez's that it came out.
Probably so. But he created a song to solve a problem. Well, I don't know if it's a problem or more of a feature, really. Just play a first song in your library when you plug your phone into the car. But he solved an annoyance by creating a 10-minute song, and so he's making bank on it. So I think it's funny.
You know, that reminds me a lot of back in the day, you know, when you used to open Winamp, it would start playing the first song. Oh, yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've had to listen to Ace of Base because of that.
It almost makes you want to just get rid of that song, but then it'll just
play
the next one.
Yeah, then you'll hate the second one.
So it's crazy. And it's like he said, in fact, his Twitter, he says, hey, I released a blank song that will play first so that in asterisks, one song won't play every time you plug your phone into your car. Everybody has that one song that they're tired of hearing.
Yep. I love it. That's ingenious. And the fact that he's making money off of a blank track is hilarious.
I just want to know how long till Apple pulls it. I hope they don't, because I'm almost tempted to give them the dollar just so I can help. Hey, I want to help be a part of this revolution.
You know what's going to happen? Apple's going to release an update that gives you the option to not autoplay.
You know, that needs to be there, and I think that's the point this guy's trying to make, but he's just making a dollar by person.
Congratulations to him.
Yeah, I think it's funny. But let's talk a little bit about Cisco, since we're going to jump into our follow-up section. And we talked about Cisco's purchase of Meraki a few episodes back when we talked about subscription services and how we're not really fans of subscription services for our network hardware. And I think this article sort of proves that point.
Yeah, I mean, they're not only a subscription service, but all your configurations and whatnot also live up in the cloud.
And so apparently Meraki or Cisco, they did some kind of update or something, and everything just went poof for a bunch of customers, and everything was blank.
Oh, goodness. I mean, this is one of those resume-generating events.
And that's one of the reasons why I don't want to do my network hardware in the cloud, because crazy stuff like this happens. And you know it happens. I mean, somebody fat fingers a command line somewhere, and AWS goes down, and so everything in the world goes down. I mean, it happens. We're only human. I mean, I do it to my local stuff all the time.
Oh, I mean, it's okay if I do it locally, but if you're Cisco and you wipe out the entire North American data center, whew, ouch. I feel bad for that engineer.
Yeah, not very good. But in other follow-up, it looks like we're right. It's almost like Microsoft is listening to our podcast. I mentioned a Mac subscription that I want, and so we come up with a Surface subscription. And so I was like, hey, I think the Linux subsystem would be great on Windows Server. And guess what? Linux subsystem is coming to Windows Server.
Hey, it's wonderful. Now, I was reading about this, and it looks like they're limiting it to non-persistent applications right now. So it's one of those things you could fire it up, run it, and then it closes. It's not anything you're going to boot the server up, and it's going to be running a Linux session in the background. But it's getting there. And I think that's the logical next step.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the reason why they're limiting it, so they can kind of test that instance, like, hey, fire it up, run this little quick thing, and then shut it down. They're going to make sure that works pretty consistently before they make it like a system service and it all runs that way.
And I love the example that they give. The first example is Node.js, which is notorious for having dependency issues on Windows. Not because the dependencies aren't there, but because the way Node does its automatic dependency resolution is it cascades the folders nested within each other. And we all know the 255 character limit that is the bane of Windows Server right now for Win32 apps. So you hit that 255 characters in the path quickly on Node applications. So I like that they're using that as their first example, because that actually solves the Node.js problem running on Windows.
So I guess we'll see where that goes. I'm really hoping that it comes the full-blown version. Basically, like you said, Windows starts up and Linux starts running in the background and your Apache sessions or whatever just start working. I really hope that that comes, because then, like you said, like I think you mentioned before on that when we talked about it, was that's they want to be the all-in-one platform for all developers, and I think that's an easy way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the only software you can't run within Windows, of course, is the macOS software. But is there really even any server-based software that runs on Mac anymore, besides, of course, the management stuff?
Not really. I mean, just about everything people do server-side with a Mac, I mean, I can run it on my Mac without the server UI. I mean, unless you wanted to do macOS Server, the app that Apple makes where you can do, like, user accounts, like you said, and Time Machine Server and stuff like that, but as far as applications or whatever go, everybody's really doing them in Linux. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why Apple released Swift for Linux, was to be able to start building those server-side applications and run them in Linux.
Well, that's cool. I guess Apple's cloud is running Linux then, isn't it?
Probably.
Especially if they got probably running Swift applications in the cloud.
Pretty sure it's running on Azure too.
Yes and no. I do remember seeing that. God, isn't that crazy to think about? Think about this paragraph we just had. We just talked about Linux applications on Windows and Apple running in Microsoft's cloud. I mean, what kind of world are we living in right now?
And in fact, like a few days ago was, I think, like the 15-year anniversary of that Apple keynote, I think from 97, where Bill Gates'
the big brother picture in the background.
Yeah, I think that was like sometime this week, that was the anniversary of that. So, I mean, it's just all crazy how everything's going full circle. And not to mention that, Apple's big partnership with IBM, pushing their stuff in for business applications.
Man, Steve would not have had that if he was around. You know how much he hated IBM.
Yeah, he did.
But it's all for the better. I mean, all of these things that all of these companies are doing, yeah, they're completely counterintuitive to what they would have been 5 years ago, but they make so much sense now.
I mean, even IBM has said that, like, everything that they've replaced with, like, Apple computers, their tech support costs have, like, dropped considerably.
Yeah, I mean, the users are actually, they get to be independent.
Which, I mean, if we ever went all Apple out here, they would be independent, because I guess Jamf and stuff makes tools to make it a little bit easier, but I mean, it's kind of a headache to manage Macs. So at least
we'll have to, there's a school in our region that is a 100% Apple school, with the exception of their business office. And we'll have to get them on here one time to talk about their management process to see how it does for them.
Well, you say that, but I think that guy's going Chromebooks.
Oh, you do? He's pulling them out?
I think all those iPads that I know that they used to have, I think a lot of those are coming out and Chromebooks are going in.
I bet I know what happened. I bet you the bond dried up and they couldn't do another one.
Probably not.
Yeah, it's a rough economy right now to do bonds.
Yes, very rough.
And I want to go ahead and say on record, the next story we talk about, I didn't even put this in the notes.
Yes, once again, I put an AMD story in the notes, because apparently you can buy them today. I mean, on Newegg or whatever, it was pre-ordered and to be released today. So, and apparently the embargo for, like, reviews, so people can actually post, like, what they found with their review units they got. And so they released the Threadripper, the 1950X and the 1920X reviews that they got. And so do you want to talk a little bit about that as far as, like, the performance goes?
Well, to AMD's credit, Infinity Fabric scales nearly 100%. I mean, they've really come up with a great... I think that is actually the winner in all of this new technology is the Infinity Fabric AMD has, because they can, as Intel says, glue cores together and actually keep performance at scale. It's incredible. Now, if you haven't had an opportunity to look at the Threadripper box or actually see one of the Threadripper CPUs, do yourself a favor and Google that real quick, because these things are massive. I mean, I have fairly large hands, and the size of these CPUs is the size of my palm. I mean, they're huge. I mean, it's like you literally have two Ryzen CPUs set beside each other. But with that, you get all of these awesome things like, well, 64 PCIe lanes, you have quad channel memory, you've 16 cores, 32 threads, and, well, XFR, where you can actually turbo boost to 4.2 gigahertz with the correct cooling.
I mean, it's just...
It's crazy.
It's an insane processor, that's for sure.
And one of the things they haven't really mentioned yet, I think it was videocards.com that I actually pulled it up. Some new Threadripper SKUs are leaking out. And just like Ryzen has like the 1700X and also a 1700, there's also going to be some non-X variants of Threadripper, which you'll be able to get cheaper. They won't have XFR, but of course, all of these CPUs are unlocked, so if you wanted to overclock it, you could still get the same speeds as those Xs.
For a cheaper price.
For a cheaper price. Why not?
But I was looking at some of the charts where they ran the tests against like Intel CPUs and like the Ryzen 7s and stuff, and it looks like Intels are still beating them out on the single core stuff, but if you look at the numbers or whatever, it's not by much. It's really not by much. But when it comes to the multi-core stuff, it's almost like Threadripper's just blowing them out of the water.
Yeah, and what's really cool is Zen 2 is almost done. So they're about to have the second generation of Ryzen cores coming out in the next year, which is going to have an IPC improvement because they're going to go from 14 nanometers, what they're manufactured on now, to 7 nanometers. So they're going to draw less power, take up less space, and have more IPC performance, which is that single core performance that AMD's always lagged behind Intel with.
Man.
Exciting times to be an AMD fan.
It is. I mean, it seems like AMD, I think, is probably going to take over the gaming market again, from what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. They've already got me.
One of the things that I noticed on all those charts or whatever, that like they listed all the processors that they compared, and nothing on that list from Intel even came near the number of cores that the Threadripper had. So it's almost like they just didn't have a review unit of it, or it's just not available. It's just not there.
Well, the i9s, Intel actually has an 18-core i9 coming out, and they're not in production enough for them to be shipping out review units. But the price is also going to be $1,900 compared to $1,000 for that 16-core Threadripper. So while they have an answer, it's an expensive answer.
And like you said, AMD is pretty much half the price of anything Intel comes out with.
Now, the thing that I'm most excited to see is when Dell starts shipping Epic servers.
Yeah, that'll be great.
I really want to see what the price is going to be on some of those. Not that I'm going to be able to buy them until they're refurbished, but...
Yeah, I just want them to start putting them in some of their desktop lineups, too, to maybe try to drop the price in those things down so I can get more machines for the amount of money that we spend.
Yeah. And hey, think about it. You get a couple of those 16-core CPUs, you could do some VDI solutions with minimal hardware.
Exactly. And probably maybe with some existing hardware in a way.
Heck yeah.
Just change out a few motherboards and pop in these new processors and just use most of your existing stuff.
That'd be a lot of fun. I think we should try that.
Maybe so. But a little bit of news. A while back, I believe at the beginning of June, Google announced that they're going to start building in an ad blocker into Chrome. And it looks like early versions of the Canary build, as of this week, are starting to have that ad blocker in there. I don't run the Canary build, so I haven't tried it yet. Most I'll ever do is developer, but for the most part, I stay on the stable build. But my question is, I run an ad blocker. I use one called OneBlocker. Blocks trackers and ads and stuff like that. But what I see is a lot of times, too, it will actually break internet web pages. Like, some things just refuse to load and things like that. So, my question to you, I mean, I think it's great that Google's doing an ad blocker. And I love that their premise or whatever, is they want the internet advertisement companies to make better ads. Which I guess they're talking to themselves, because that's essentially what they are, as an ad company. So, how do you think this having a built-in ad blocker is going to have an effect on us, and maybe some of the even like these older applications that are web-based that we use?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to end up functioning a lot like the built-in pop-up blockers, where you'll have a slight management piece on it where you can add, remove, and allow sites to it. But what I'm really kind of curious to is, you know, those sites, when you go to them, it's like, hey, we see you're running an ad blocker. Please turn it off to visit this site. Are they going to do that for all Chrome users now?
I mean, maybe. I mean, they're essentially doing it for everybody in Chrome that's running an ad blocker right now. So, I mean.
Yeah, I can't remember what site it was, but I was going to a business's site the other day to get a download of a driver or something. Not anything where they would have an advertising on it. But it still prompted me to disable AdBlocker before I went to their site, even though there was no advertising on the page. And I just, oh, I can't stand that, people.
I can't log into my Time Warner account online without disabling my AdBlocker.
Doesn't it drive you crazy?
I mean, it does. I mean,
and here's the thing. I really don't mind advertising being on a web page. Just don't get in the way of the content. I mean, don't put an ad in the middle of a paragraph, or when I start scrolling down, move the text down and throw an ad in front of my face real quick. I can't stand those things. Yeah, that's the reason I run them.
I mean, there was this one advertisement company called The Deck that did like real nice ads. I mean, it was just a small little image that loaded in the corner or wherever you put it, maybe a line of text. I mean, it was just real nice. It was there. But yeah, sometimes I clicked on those images just so that site can get a little bit of revenue, because I mean, a lot of like blogs that we go to or whatever, that's how they're supported. They're supported by advertisements, Amazon affiliate links, iTunes affiliate links, things like that. That's how they make their money, to be able to pay their writers to make content. And a lot of times the writers don't even work for them. They're all freelance people.
I mean, I really don't mind advertising. In fact, I like some advertising. If I'm reading an article, let's say, about a certain software product, and an ad is nicely done on the right-hand column or something of another software product like it, I'm more inclined to click that ad to find out about it because it was relevant to what I was doing. But full screen ads? No. Those should just be banned.
Autoplay videos ads?
Ugh.
No.
Ugh.
And ads that... What really get... The one reason why I run them, and I really have no need to because I'm probably not as affected as most people, but those ads that start running the JavaScript that start doing the Flash stuff, which brings in the malware and all that other fun stuff, those are the things that I want to avoid. I don't want any of that stuff.
Yeah. Or, I love those ads that do that secret pop under where you don't know it's popped up until after you start closing pages.
Oh, and it's still playing audio really loud.
Yeah, yes. Where in the world? I don't see anything playing. And then it's like this little bitty tiny window popped under.
I mean, I guess gone are the days of the Punch the Monkey advertisements where it was just a web banner at the top. I mean, those are sort of fun. It's like you sit there and you try to punch the monkey, and when you do, you just close the tab that opens. So you can play the little game, because it's kind of fun to punch the monkey, but yeah, close the tab before anything loads.
No, but I mean, if ads are done really well, and they're relevant to the content, I'm perfectly fine leaving them turned on and looking at them and actually paying attention to what they are.
And see, and that's what's hard. That's what's going to be hard about this is the trackers part of it. And that's another piece that I really don't like. I don't like to be tracked around on the internet. Like, you look at some socks on Amazon, and now all of a sudden every site you go to, you're seeing advertisements for socks. I mean, I don't like that.
You're having to punch the sock monkey.
Push the sock monkey now, yeah. So, I mean, it's things like that. It's like, do your ads based on the content of what you're putting ads on, as opposed to the browsing history of the person browsing the web page. Like, don't make your ads based what you think is relevant to me based on something that I've looked at before, but maybe something that I'm looking at now. Because like you said, if you see a piece of software that in another ad for like either another piece of software or something like it, or something that goes along with that software, hey, if you like this, maybe you want to try this, you'd be more apt to click on that as opposed to seeing some socks advertisement on a software page or whatever. So, I mean,
oh, of course. And like I said, a well-done ad that gets information, I'll actually click on it to see what I'm missing.
But yeah, but the one thing I worry about, though, I mean, not so much the ads or whatever, I don't care if those go away for our kids, or the trackers, but I just don't want it to break anything. I don't want it to break any web pages. So I'm really anxious to see how Google's going to implement this. If it's going to be off by default and you can turn it on, or is it going to be on by default and you have to turn it off, or and how restrictive is it going to be? Because the ad blocker that I run, I can even do like I can click a little button and it can be like pick an element on the page and it will hide that element, and so yes. I can get like real granular with mine. So I doubt Google's going to go that far, but.
No, I can't see them going that far, but I can see them 100% by default, any of their customers' ads go through.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that would be suicide if they did.
Well, I mean, there was a there was an ad company that actually, I think it was like Adblocker Plus or something like that, that got into a little hot water that they were actually charging advertisement companies to not block their ads. And so that was the way they were making money.
Man, I mean, it's a clever business model.
But then how do you know, I mean, okay. I mean, you get some people that are making some malicious ads and they paid you. You're not going to block them even though they're malicious? I mean, hey, what do you do? How do you, I mean...
I guess you just better have a good editor, because if you're gonna get into the market of whose ads you allow, whose ads you don't, even within your own market, man, you better be careful, otherwise you'll lose your whole base.
But I even know of a podcast app that he wanted to move to an ad supported revenue, as opposed to a one time purchase or whatever, which you can of course do a subscription and avoid all ads. Period, but. He didn't even want to do other people's code inside of his app. And so he even went as far as to build his own ad platform. And so now as a revenue stream for him, he's actually selling ads to run on his app. So he's selling his app, or he's got a subscription model to kill the ads in it, or you could buy an ad from him.
That's cool. I mean, I guess it worked out for him because his app only shows the ads that his publishers want to use.
Well, and most of the time, since it's a podcast app, it's a lot of times it's just other podcasts or podcasts advertising their shows or whatever. And the way he built it, it's like you can click the ad and it'll go straight to that podcast where you can either download it or subscribe to it. I mean, it's really good how he did it. But I mean, it's a lot of curation on his part. Yes. I don't know how much, I think other than the purchasing part of it and maybe like designing your ad that shows up, which it's very limited to what you can and cannot do, obviously. But I don't know how much of it is automated, because he does say that he has the right to reject any ads that he wants to not run.
And he should. It is his application and his reputation.
So, I mean, it's almost like that's the other alternative. If you want to run good ads on your website, it may just be best to just run your own ad network.
Now, I know a couple of years ago I did some work for a local AM radio station here, a talk radio station, and I had built them... on their website, they had their own ad network that they had, and we presented it to their podcast, to their mobile app, so they could say, hey, y'all want to go to XYZ Bank down the road, you want to support our station, and by the way, hey, you can support either through our website or through our website and our mobile app, and it was kind of a selling point for them.
I mean, ads have their place, but when your ad infrastructure is so integrated into your web page or whatever, that when ads get blocked, your page gets broken, that's when it becomes a problem.
Yeah, and this is kind of funny. It was probably about a month and a half ago, the blog of Windows Central started turning on that thing where if you have the pop-up blocker enabled, it won't let you go to the site. I didn't recognize the website after the ads were on. The layout was completely different. I mean, it doesn't feel like I'm going to the same site anymore now that I have the ad blocker disabled on it. And it's kind of confusing for me to get the actual content.
And see, the ad blocker conversation really didn't start until... Well, I mean, it was always there, but I mean, it really kicked off whenever Apple started allowing ad blockers in iOS 9, I think is when it was, or iOS 10. I think it was 9. They started allowing ad blockers or whatever, because what the problem they were trying to solve is... they were looking at how much data your phone was pulling for a web page while you were browsing the internet or whatever. And so you would take a web page like The Verge or something like that, which I love The Verge, don't get me wrong. I get a lot of links for our show from The Verge. But you would take like an 8 megabyte page download on mobile and knock it down to like 512 kilobits or kilobytes.
Oh, yeah. And think of the CPU burden that's lifted, too, on those, especially back in the day when the mobile CPUs weren't very powerful.
But not only that, what about people that are on metered data plans? I mean, and that's essentially what it was for, was to try to cut down on some of your data, your mobile data usage. So, but like I said, I'm a little leery about it because I don't want it to break anything. Because once Chrome does it, Firefox is going to do it, if they haven't already. They may even already do it, because they even have an app on the phone that's an ad blocker already on iOS.
Oh, I mean, everybody's going to start doing it. But then it's probably going to, ad networks are going to get obfuscated more, where we won't be able to see what's actually coming from an ad network and what's not coming from an ad network and those kind of things. It's going to get real difficult for those ad blocking developers to actually block ads.
I mean, I could even take it one step further. Our eyeballs filter as even has a category that says block advertisements. And I'm tempted to turn it on because I think it would be great to just block this stuff or whatever. But I don't want, like, little block pages showing up all over.
Yeah. Well, actually, in our infrastructure, I deploy AdBlock Plus through the Chrome, through the Google Apps console.
Do you have any problems with, like, any, like, websites that, like, think through math or anything with anything like that?
I haven't had a problem yet, and it saves a ton of bandwidth.
Well, good. I mean, so maybe I'm thinking nuts.
I think you are, though, because we also got to remember these ad blockers are intercepting the web content. So if something's, let's say they do an update and something kind of funny and the ad blocker is messed up and it starts rendering the pages incorrectly.
In fact, I know a ad blocker that a lot of times their release notes for new versions of their application fixed whatever.com. Fix this website, fix this rendering of the website. But like you said, it's capturing everything. I mean, even usernames and passwords if you're using an unencrypted website or whatever and putting in user accounts and you're running an ad blocker. I mean, that information might be getting back to the developer.
Well, think about this. It's de-encrypted by the time it gets to the ad blocker because ad blockers work on HTTPS sites.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just... It's crazy when you think about it.
There's a lot going on with them. There's the potential for a lot to go wrong. But I think it's kind of bringing to the attention how ridiculous some of these advertising networks have become.
No doubt. I guess the main thing I wanted to avoid being a headache like when Chrome killed Flash running automatically, how that was for me. That's like, why is everything broken?
I just went into the console and said, always Flash.
Yeah, that's essentially what I did. It took me a minute to realize what was happening. It was like, hey, this site was working yesterday, but it's not working today. I'm like, well, I didn't change anything. And then I was like, oh, Chrome updated, and Chrome killed Flash from running automatically. So I run back to my computer, open up Group Policy Management Console, click the little create allow Flash to always run GPU, and then just push it out to everybody. And we recently had to do it, too, with... we changed our student information system, and it is all about them pop-ups. I mean, everything has to do with a pop-up. And so I had to do the same thing, and it's like, after about the third person that I manually did it to, I was like, there's got to be a way to do this in Group Policy. And so I think I messaged you, and by the time you responded, I had found it and already pushed it out. So I was like, yes.
And if anybody that writes that piece of software, it's called Texas, not spelled like Texas, because we're at education, we can't spell. But please stop making blank pop-up windows to download files.
I know.
It drives me crazy.
I had a lady, she called me, she says, I clicked the button, I can't find my download or whatever. And it's all like, I moved the window up and there it was down at
yes.
the bottom.
Yes, and they're making the window larger than the resolution of the monitor.
It's crazy. I mean, it's so bad.
Just stop it.
Such a headache. run something other than Java.
Oh, goodness.
But
yes.
Enough of ad blockers. Hopefully it won't be a problem. I want to jump into today's topic. We've been talking a lot about Windows and Office and software subscription stuff like that. So today, and I know you're real familiar with this, so you may have to take the lead on this a lot, but I wanted to give our listeners a chance to maybe learn about some alternatives to Windows and Office and other software that we purchase. Music editors, video editors, photo editors, things like that. So you're an open source fanboy. When I first met you, I mean, you were pretty much running Linux everywhere. But obviously Linux is an alternative to Windows. I mean, a lot of times it's free unless you go Red Hat and basically you're just paying for support. And you've actually used Linux in the school district because I remember... Mm-hmm. There was like a distance learning class that students had to have laptops and you threw Ubuntu on there. Now, since Linux comes in a variety of flavors, what do you kind of recommend as sort of something, somebody coming from a Windows environment to be most comfortable with? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, and generally I make these same recommendations unless it's a real specific server use case. If you're going to be running Linux as your desktop, definitely pick one that's based on Debian or Ubuntu. And the reason I say that is the communities behind those are enormous. There's a ton of help articles. There's a ton of packages already developed for them. There's just a ton of free support that's available for Debian and Ubuntu-based distributions. And And actually, you run Ubuntu servers there in your school, and you use one of the management products called Landscape.
I do.
To manage some of your servers. And you probably noticed that Landscape actually has some desktop management in there, too.
It does.
So, I mean, if you are looking for a solution where you can do some desktop management easy, Ubuntu with Landscape, Landscape is not free after you get over a certain number. With 10?
10, yeah. And I have like 7 servers, so I mean, I'm fitting like right under that threshold.
Yeah, but it's a good solution. It gives you a lot of control about updates and different policies and whatnot you can do to those machines to help manage them, because it is a tremendous change from managing a Windows environment with group policy. There's really not a parallel for group policy in the open source world. There's some things that you can make do it, like gcomp, which is the GNU configuration manager. But there's not really any back-end stuff that ties it together. I mean, but yeah, rant for to say, definitely choose a Debian or an Ubuntu-based distribution. Now, with that, there's probably, 500,000 in that category?
Yeah, no kidding.
There's a ton.
And what's funny is... we're saying pick an Ubuntu flavor, Ubuntu based flavor,
but don't
pick Ubuntu desktop because until they get rid of Unity, because Unity is so bad,
and they abandon it themselves. I mean, they're going to be moving back to GNOME and their next distribution, and that's one of the things that you'll notice when you start getting into the Linux world is there's a lot of choice into how you want your machine to operate. And, I mean, just off the top of my head, the popular desktop environments, which is basically the user interface that you're presented with to do your task, are, well, Unity, GNOME, KDE, XFCE, we got Cinnamon, we got Mate, we got Pantheon, we have Bungie. I mean, and all of those are excellent choices. I can't tell you that's anything wrong with any of them. It comes down to personal preference.
So I know since you're teaching this next year, I know you had to put together a lab. What version of Linux did you go with for the desktops for your students to use?
I actually went with Budgiebuntu, which is Ubuntu with the Budgie desktop.
Yeah, I think I saw that. It's really nice. I like it.
It was a really tough debate for me between elementary OS and that one, because I really like the Pantheon desktop, but Pantheon... It will work on Ubuntu, but it really likes the elementary OS better, and they tend to have older packages in there because they're a long-term support distribution.
The only thing I didn't like about Budgie is Budgie didn't play well in a VM too well, and I think it has something to do with like video drivers or something.
Well, I mean, in a lot of the modern distribution, a lot of modern desktop environments, GNOME included, they use compositing, which is actually rendering on your video card. So if you don't have an actual driver in there that can do OpenGL, they don't run real well.
Yeah, but even then, like the Ubuntu desktop with Unity, it didn't run very well.
Yeah, and it was actually a compositing engine too. So I mean, they have these, they call them fail-safes, which are software mode rendering. They take out like the animations and the transparencies and the fading and whatnot, to where if you wanted to run them in a virtual machine, it'd run just fine, but they're kind of ugly.
Yeah, I couldn't even get it to run at full screen resolution.
Oh, goodness. Sounds like you're trying to virtualize a Mac.
It was like 800 by 600 stuck in the middle of my screen. It was really weird.
Oh, that's horrible.
But so what about Office? Are there any versions? Is there anything out there that can replace Office, should one choose?
Well, there is. And, of course, if you're just concerned about free, well, we all know Google Docs is there. We all know Microsoft has their online versions for free. But if you're wanting an actual application on your desktop, there's a couple to choose from. I'm sure you remember OpenOffice from the way back days. OpenOffice still exists. It's in the Apache Foundation now. And it moved from being a Sun Microsystems project to an Oracle project to being abandoned, and then Apache taking it back under its wing and bringing it back to a usable product. But... one of them, during the kind of chaotic period between OpenOffice that became about, was called LibreOffice. And there's an actual foundation behind it that does support and development for it. So I think they're at version 4.5? Let me look it up real quick.
Didn't LibreOffice actually fork off of OpenOffice?
Yes, it did. And
for the listeners that may not understand, fork means it's like a group of people are developing this, and then development kind of slows down or whatever, and so another group of development kind of takes the code and like turns it into another product. But since it's all open source and released under that open license or whatever, they can kind of do that. And so that's what it means by forking into like another product. And so that's kind of what LibreOffice did.
Oh yeah, they forked OpenOffice. They took out a lot of the old crud that was just abandoned code and cleaned it up really nicely. And what they've done is they've made it a lot faster. And they've even made versions that you can install on your servers and run in a cloud infrastructure too, kind of like have your own Google Docs. Now it was version 5.4. I had them backwards. But it's getting better with every release. It is leaps and bounds more feature complete than any online version of Google or Microsoft can ever be. I mean, it does everything from documents, spreadsheets, presentations, databases, to technical drawings. I mean, it's a full-featured product. It has every parallel that you would want from the Microsoft Office world, and it is free.
And, like, aren't you on your Windows desktop actually running that instead of Microsoft Office anyway?
I am. It's a heck of a lot cheaper to buy.
Free 50 free.
Free 50 free. And honestly, it does some things better. Now, you probably have students that come in or they have these crazy file formats. Generally, LibreOffice can open them. They can open those old obscure Word perfect documents and continue working. Even the old Microsoft Works ones that Office won't open. So, I mean,
it's like it's the VLC for productivity.
It is. And sadly, I use it a lot for that. It just kind of does everything.
Works 4.5. Oh, man, I remember that. Can it open Corel? Word perfect?
Yes, it can. It can. Now, one of the things I always thought was really funny is LibreOffice was the first Office product to support Microsoft's OpenOffice XML format. It supported it before Microsoft Office did.
That's crazy.
I know. It was one of those, what? Really?
That's really funny.
But it's a great product. I can't recommend it enough. I mean, I have the option to use whatever I want. And if I'm going to use a thick client for an Office application, I'm going to go to LibreOffice every time. I mean, it's just a good product. I mean, I do all my network maps and whatnot in LibreOffice to have it not locked down to a platform like Visio.
Yeah.
Even though Visio is wonderful.
Yeah, I have a Windows virtual machine just to run Visio.
Mm-hmm. You should try the LibreOffice Draw. You can import. You can use all those Cisco stencils in it too.
I need to try that. In fact, I can install that straight on my Mac without any problems.
Yeah, not even have to virtualize it.
It's everywhere.
Now, not going to break your. I might break your heart just a little. LibreOffice does use a lot of Java code.
Oh.
You don't have to have Java installed. It's all embedded with it.
Okay. So that's all that matters.
But we got to remember where it originated from. Sun Microsystems, who created Java.
That's true. But you know, though, I mean, Java is like one of the biggest, if not the biggest.
It is the biggest.
Programming language, because Java runs everywhere. I mean, it runs on everything. Yep.
And you know, and this is actually a hard statistic to believe, but Java is the second fastest programming language for running code.
Only
C beats it.
That is hard to believe, considering how much all these plugins and stuff. I mean, because when a non-developer thinks about Java, I think about the browser plugin and how terrible it makes the browsing experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that's really got a bad reputation from the users, from the developer community. They kind of ignore that because it's still the most popular language. And in fact, it's what all the computer science students have to learn.
Okay, so we got an alternative for Windows, and we got an alternative for Office, and probably for 90% of the uses of our school district, that's going to be enough. But sometimes we need to like edit photos, we need to edit PDFs, we need to edit music, we need to edit videos. Are there any kind of open source tools out there to be able to do those sort of things, as opposed to buying Adobe Audition or Premiere or Acrobat or anything like that?
Yeah, on photo editing, there's a really old project that's been around for a long time. It's called the GNU Image Manipulation Program.
Yeah, we actually talked about that.
We did, and that's why I went ahead and set it all the way out.
Yeah, the GIMP program. I'll say it, the GIMP program.
It's got an awful name, but it makes a lot of sense. We got to remember, too, that most of these open source projects are not 100% English-speaking people. I mean, so these acronyms are acronyms. They're not slang terms that we've learned.
Yeah.
But the GIMP is fantastic. It has probably about an 80% feature complete of Adobe Photoshop. It does some things really well. It does some things really different. But it can do just about everything. And it's on every platform, whether you're on Windows, Linux, or Mac. And then there is one that I really do use a lot, and I do deploy to our staff here. It is a Windows-only program. It's called Paint.net. I think we might have mentioned this one in the past, too.
Yeah, we did talk about Paint.net, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, those are basically the two biggies that are out there for that. They're both open source. They're both free. So if you ever ask to pay for it, it's not the right one.
Yeah, it's not from the right place. Don't pay for the GIMP or Paint.net.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll skip over those because we've done those. We've talked about those in the past. And, well, a photo editor is a photo editor. But as far as, like, audio editing and whatnot for, say, doing a podcast, I mean, there is the oldie. And still much used goodie, Audacity. Ugliest interface you'll ever see.
Oh, yes. I mean, I use Audacity for editing this. I use it, I actually run our audio tracks through Audacity first before I bring them into Logic to kind of denoise them a little bit. So, I mean, it's real easy, real handy, but like you said, it is ugly. It's almost like made for 1995, so.
Yeah, I think they must have, like, brought some of the Windows 95 code into that program to use because it's atrocious the way it looks.
Yeah.
But it does all sorts of cool stuff.
I mean, it's got tons of plugins, a lot of plugins.
Yes, and you can do anything with it. I mean, it's an unlimited multi-track editor. I mean, but if you want something that looks a little prettier, there's one called LMMS, and it's a fairly newer product, and it's a multi-track audio editor. It's really geared towards music versus, say, a podcast, because it has a lot of MIDI and synthesizer plugin stuff built into it automatically. And I think they even offer some basic support on it, which is kind of cool. A lot of these projects don't. They do.
Yeah, a lot of times open source products, they sort of just rely on the community of users to be able to provide support. Or if the people actually writing some of the code have a little bit of time, they may answer some support questions in the forums or whatever.
Yeah, but you'll quickly learn that programmers are not good customer support representatives.
Those are usually the ones where you get the RTFM response from.
Oh, yes.
For a lot of people, I mean, we talked about that before, that's actually what scared a lot of people in our area away from using Linux for anything, because that's all you ever get. But thanks to websites like DigitalOcean and Linode or whatever, they're writing Linux tutorials that are actually for the normal people, not these developers or whatever, that can understand these complex things, and they break it down to make it easy for us to understand. And that's really one of the reasons why I've basically jumped headfirst into a bunch of Linux stuff, is because I'm finding better tutorials out there than what you could 5-10 years ago.
You actually get a parachute now instead of just jumping off the cliff.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice.
So are there any other music editors?
Well, there is one. It is open source. It is 100% free. It kind of has a weird reputation right now because they have for Windows users, they do some weird things. Like, they make it stop every 10 minutes for some odd reason. But it's actually a really good program. It's called Ardour. And it came about when another audio program called Jack was first being introduced in the open source world. And what it basically tries to do is take all of these racks and all of this other stuff and just compress it into this digital software package, so you need absolutely nothing but your audio interface. And it does musical instruments, synthesizers, voice recording. And it has a lot of really good features. It is more complicated to use because of all those features, but it does have a really nice looking UI. And disclosure, I'd actually donate to this project. I like this project. I want them to get better and better.
And that's kind of how you get past the those weird limitations or whatever, is you actually have to donate money to those things. Money to them, donate a few bucks or whatever. But it's like a perpetual thing. It's like you donate once and you can just keep getting all the updates or whatever without the restrictions, right?
Correct. And in fact, I have an account. What they do is they basically add you a Drupal account into their website, and then your account always has access to download.
So, I mean, it's pretty cool. But what about video editing? I mean, because not everybody can afford Premiere Pro, right?
No, and I wish you all could, because it's a good project. I mean, a good product. But there are a couple projects out there that are trying to make video, non-linear video editing available to everyone. The two top ones that come to mind that are open source is Kden Live, which is actually part of the KDE desktop environment. But KDE's applications run on a framework called Qt. So they run on Windows, Mac, and Linux. So Kden Live is actually available on every platform, too. And it has a lot of features. it doesn't have, of course, any kind of feature complete when you start taking into like After Effects and those things.
Yeah.
But it'll get you through. It'll get you through some basic video editing.
Yeah, especially like if you want to start doing some like YouTube stuff or whatever.
Oh yeah, it has a really easy to learn interface. I mean, it reminds me a lot of Premiere Elements as far as its feature set,
mm-hmm.
which is not bad for a lot of people.
Which that's actually what we use. Well, we did use. We haven't got our new version yet because we're waiting for the new school year and budget year to roll over. But for the most part, that's what we were using as Premiere Elements.
Yeah, I mean, and it's good. And there's another one that I really, really, really want to like, but I've yet to get it to install and run on my work machine. It works fine at the house and on my Linux machines. It's called OpenShot, and it has a nice interface. It's built all its video editing around the FFmpeg architecture, so it can do basically any video format. It can render out to basically any format, too. And it has a lot of those niceties pre-done in there. You can do some 3D text with it, and it actually brings in some of the Blender libraries, Blender 3D, which is a 3D modeling tool that's open source to do them. So they look really nice. And OpenShot is available on multi-platform, too. I'm not sure it's available on Mac, but it is on Windows and Linux. But then again, if you're on a Mac, you're probably going to use iMovie or something of that nature that's already included. Those are phenomenal.
Yeah, iMovie's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, those are a couple of them that are in there. Now, those are multimedia apps. I mean, a lot of multimedia apps are what users are wanting to use. In the office, of course, so they can do their documents. But there's a ton of open source projects out there to do everything from the mundane management stuff to completely automate everything.
I mean, unless there's an application that your school actually needs that is only Windows. I mean, I think the only thing that can pop to my head is the application we have to use for state testing for Texas. I'm not so sure that they have a Linux version. I know they have a Mac.
They do.
Oh, they do? Oh, well, great. Never
yeah,
mind.
When you go to their site to download, Linux is actually the first one.
Oh, great.
And they support Debian distributions.
Well, I mean, other than that, I mean, most everything we have is, except for that one typing program that's 14 years old, everything we have is web-based. So, I mean, and Firefox comes pre-installed in every version of Linux.
Oh, yeah.
Or you can install and Chromium.
You can throw in Chromium in there.
Which is basically Chrome. Well, I mean, it is yep. Chrome.
With a blue icon.
Yeah. So, I mean, for just about anything that you need to do in your school, I mean, there's probably an open source alternative to anything. There's Foxit for PDF readers, and there's like a paid version of Foxit, but I know there's a free version of Foxit that can like view PDF readers. And I'm sure Linux has a built-in PDF viewer.
Oh, yeah.
Or there's always just opening it in the browser. So, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are some more enterprise-y open source solutions that could really affect your users. Like one that we discussed last week was that PWM for self-service portal for password management. But there's even some for like VDI where you can do a full VDI infrastructure with an open source. Ultio is one of them. If you like the old Citrix model where they go to a website, they pick an app and it loads up in there. Ultio is an open source clone essentially of Citrix. I'm also using a product out here called Guacamole, which is VDI kind of slammed together with an RDP proxy with some other management tools in there, which lets you present remote connections to a user through a clientless browser client.
And yeah, because as a network admin, that's definitely something we need to have, is we need to have a way to get into machines remotely and to be able to see what the user's seeing at any given time to help them out and do stuff. But yeah, I mean, we talked a lot over the past few weeks about Microsoft pricing and all this stuff that Microsoft is doing, but we just want our listeners to know that there's other alternatives out there that probably for the most part of what your user base needs, there's an open source alternative for it. And so that's always something to consider, especially a lot of times if you have older hardware that's laying around that's still good but can't necessarily run the new version of Windows 10 or sometimes even Windows 7. A lot of times you can find a Linux distribution that you can throw on that guy and it'll run until hardware fails in it and keep getting updates and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's great that there's alternatives for out there.
And if any of the users, anyone listening has questions on it, I really don't. I ate the stuff up. Ping me. Ask me a question.
Yeah, he is.
I love it. I get excited about CPUs and open source.
Yeah, no lie about that. In fact, I mean, he does a lot of it at his school, and he actually convinced me to do a lot of it over here. And it's like whenever I'm standing up something new, one of the first things that go through my head is, can I run this in Ubuntu, or does it have to run in Windows? Because it's just sometimes running it in Ubuntu is just a little bit easier than running it in Windows. But you mentioned running like a whole VDI in open source. I mean, you can run your whole virtualization interface in mm-hmm. open source with like KVM and all that other stuff. So
yep, KVM. And if you're interested in any of that, check out a project called Overt. It can replace your VMware infrastructure for free.
And in fact, we talked about the Landscape thing. If you actually run KVM, you can actually Landscape will actually see your VMs as VMs and not necessarily physical servers, and you'll actually get 50 licenses for those and not just 10. So, or something like that. Yeah. So you get a lot more out of Landscape using the free stuff, but I get by with just my 10 clients. So, but that's our show for this week. We just wanted to give some alternatives to Windows and Office, because we know that especially this time of year, school districts are strapped and it's time to renew software licenses. And if anybody was out there looking to do something new, we just wanted to kind of throw some ideas out there, some possibilities. Now, I haven't discussed this with Chris yet, but next week, we're going to do it. We're going to do net neutrality. I've been reading into it and finding some things, and so we're going to hit it next week. But like Chris mentioned, if you have any questions about open source anything, reach out to him on Twitter at @feeks. I'm at @twistofmatt, which, like I said, I think last week, I can direct you to Chris on Twitter for any kind of questions you have on that. Or you can contact the show account at Educating Tech. You can send us a feedback email at educatingtech@gmail.com. Or for more episodes or show notes, you can visit educatingtech.net, where you will also find links to subscribe to our podcast in your app of choice and have it downloaded automatically. But that's our show for this week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. See you later, Chris.
See you later, Matt.